Potter County in the Texas Panhandle is seeing more than its share of coronavirus cases, at least population-wise. We'll get a look on the ground today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. What's voting going to look like in Texas come November? Turns out folks have very strong opinions about this. We'll hear from some. And we'll hear again from our go-to doctor for questions about the coronavirus. One question for today, the risk of sending kids back to childcare. And if your thumb has become a little greener during this pandemic, you're not alone, not now and not historically. Those stories and more on today's Texas Standard. You've got it tuned to the Texas Standard this Friday, May 22nd. I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown, and if it sounds a little funny, it's because I'm joining you from my home. I've turned this strange room next to my garage into a studio, and, well, as you can hear, it's not perfect. Hopefully what you won't hear are my two babies. My husband is doing his best to kid wrangle for the next hour or so mommy can do the radio. Though the details are different, this story probably sounds awfully familiar to you. As I take a look at the map on our website tracking the spread of COVID-19, I see little red dots over most of Texas and some bigger red dots over the metro areas, especially Houston, Dallas, and Fort Worth. It looks like the state of Texas has the chicken pox, but of course it's much more serious than that. One area on this map that's seen an outsized proportion of COVID-19 cases is Amarillo. To be specific, Potter County. The latest numbers I have show the top five cases by county are also the top five most populous counties. But number six in raw number of cases is Potter County, which by population ranks way down at 38. Outbreaks at meatpacking facilities have driven the county's coronavirus count to nearly 2,200. That's the second worst outbreak on a per capita basis in Texas. And that's why Governor Greg Abbott left Potter County out of today's new phase of reopening. For a closer look at what's happening in the area, we turn to Potter County Judge Nancy Tanner. Judge Tanner, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much, Laura. Thanks for having me this morning.
Do you know what percentage of Potter County's coronavirus cases are related to people who work at meatpacking facilities?
I do not know the exact percentage, but I do know it's pretty high. We have 2,202 cases as of today, with 31 deaths in Potter County. And I cannot tell you which one, how many of those are directly from the meatpacking company here that we have in Amarillo. I would say probably more than half. They had 4,000 employees all tested, and out of the 4,000 employees that they tested, about 700 of them tested positive.
I see. Now you're speaking to that government intervention there, and actually the federal government sent a strike force to Potter County to stop
the
spread.
They sure did. The mayor and I both reached out to the governor, and this was a couple of weeks ago, and I just called his office, called the main number, and left a message. And I thought, well, I won't hear back from him. But still, he knows that we need help. And lo and behold, he called me back. And he told me, he said, we're sending help. And that was on a Friday night. So on Monday morning, they came in full force, CDC, the National Guard, and they started testing. And they got all 4,000 of them tested. You know, and you can't, personally, you cannot blame these people. If they don't work, they don't get paid. And if they don't get paid, they don't eat. So, it's a catch-22 for them. And so it's really a sad situation for these people. A lot of Amarillo, and I love the spirit of Amarillo. We have collected thousands of pounds of food and about $4,000 worth of gift cards to grocery stores so people can go buy food for their families, because if they can't work, they don't get paid, like I said. So we're trying to help them out a little bit as best as we can.
So how are the county's healthcare resources holding up so far?
You know what? It's great. We're doing great with our hospitals. I think they peaked out a couple of weeks ago, and we have two major hospitals, Northwest Texas and also BSA, and both hospitals had less than 70 people in a bed, hospital bed, and only 14 people were on vents. So far, the survival rate is like 98%.
Governor Abbott actually exempted Potter County from the latest phase of reopening. What's your reaction to that?
I'm okay with that. I'm okay with it because the reason that I did not open the county this last Monday is twofold. Number one, our numbers were still pretty high, and I'm waiting for them to come down. And they are finally leveling out and not increasing by 100 a day. I'm waiting for those numbers to level out and to start falling. And then also, school is out now, officially out, and and daycare. The daycares will be opening on June the 1st. So we have a lot of employees. We have 600 employees, and some of them rely on that health care for their children. So I didn't want to make them suffer even more and have to take more time off to stay home with their kids. So that's why I waited till the 1st, and just to give it more time for the numbers to come down.
Mm-hmm. Could anything happen that would make you say, wait a minute, the 1st is too early, or you think the county's going to be ready then?
Absolutely. Things could happen. This is a long holiday weekend. I don't know what people have planned. You can't enforce it. You know, you can't go around and police everybody. So I don't know if there's going to be picnics and get-togethers and whatever they're supposed to be doing or supposed to be not doing. So the numbers could go up. And I am so ready. If the numbers start spiking again, I will shut it down again.
Judge Tanner, do you mind letting me know what this has been like for you personally?
Well, personally, it's been a nightmare. I've been judge. This is my seventh year as county judge, and I've been with the county for 30 years. We've had floods. We've had fires. All those were bad. Last year, we had a cyber attack. I thought, what else could happen? That was the worst. And then this happened, and I got to tell you, this is the worst thing that I have experienced for my county and for the people in my county and my life. And I hope I never have to do it again. To worry about someone's health is a lot worse than worrying about their computer. So, yes, it's been pretty tough on me. I've had some sleepless nights, and I've shed some tears because I don't know, you know, if I'm doing the right thing. And I'm hoping I am. And so I do the best I can.
Nancy Tanner is the Potter County judge. Judge Tanner, thank you again.
You are so welcome. Thank you so much, and have a nice weekend.
It's been a roller coaster week in Texas when it comes to who can vote by mail. Right now, Texas has a limited mail ballot system, and there have been a series of legal challenges to that both in state and federal courts. Turns out many have strong opinions about how we should vote during a pandemic. At least that's what Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider found.
Tamara Sell moved to Houston's Montrose area from Seattle. COVID-19 or not, she's ready to vote in person if she has to.
I will likely risk my health and go vote because it's really important to me with a mask, social distancing as much as I can with all the measures in place.
Sell works as a deputy voter registrar.
I communicate with a lot of other people. I don't necessarily feel comfortable encouraging them to vote and risking their life, or especially if they have health conditions.
If a deputy registrar is that worried, then what about the average voter? Rice University recently surveyed Harris County voters. Political scientist Bob Stein says nearly 70% of respondents preferred voting by mail if that's an option.
We found that a large number of voters, particularly Democrats, women, and persons over 65, were reluctant to vote in person at a polling location on or before Election Day.
But Attorney General Ken Paxton interprets Texas law that only one of those groups, those over 65, can automatically ask for a mail-in ballot.
I'm over 65, so if I want to vote by mail, I can.
Tom Berg is an Army veteran who lives near Memorial Park.
Traditionally, I've gotten in line with everybody else and done that. And it gives me pause that we may have to socially distance or be exposed to the coronavirus in order to exercise the franchise.
Rice's Bob Stein also found African Americans are far more nervous about voting in person than whites.
I think what you've got here is that African Americans are overwhelmingly Democratic, slightly more likely to be over 65, and skewed towards women.
The coronavirus has disproportionately impacted African Americans in Houston and around the country. Kathleen Leonard is African American and over 65. She lives in Southwest Houston and used to direct a nonprofit.
I'm going to vote. Bottom line, I am going to vote. So if I absolutely had to go to the poll, I would go to the poll. But I sure hope that is not the situation, because I have a 102-year-old mother who will vote absentee ballot, and I'm with her every other day, and I don't want to get something that I then bring back to her. That would be terrifying.
But the Rice survey shows Republicans are far less likely to want to vote by mail, let alone to support others doing so for fear of catching COVID-19. One of the big reasons, they told me, is potential voter fraud. Such fraud is extremely rare. Michael Palmquist is a Republican poll judge and Army veteran from Spring. As for concerns about voting in person during the pandemic?
None whatsoever. I mean, if I can go to the grocery store and I can go to Sam's and I can go to Walmart, there's no reason I can't stand in line and vote.
And Joanne Thomas, a teacher from West Houston, is battling cancer, but she's still determined to vote in person, not by mail.
I will wear my gloves. I will wear my mask. And I will go in and vote. I have family members who have died for the right for me to vote.
And she says anyone else who wants to vote should also have to show up in person with a valid picture ID. In Houston, I'm Andrew Schneider.
Wells Dunbar, as you know, is our social media editor, and he's watching the conversation online. Wells, good to talk with you again.
Hi, Laura. Good to talk to you as well. Well, we're hearing from our friends and listeners about the reopening of Texas businesses. Bars can open at 25% capacity in Texas today. Restaurant capacity expanded to 50%. Rodeos, bowling alleys, and bingo halls can open as well. We've asked our friends and listeners if they'll be venturing out. On our Facebook page, Matt Weiss says, I'm going to see how Dallas is doing toward the end of June before spending too much time outside the home. He adds that it helps. I've got a well-stocked bar. Patrick Schubert says, as much as I would love to hoist a beer and enjoy some tacos at my favorite restaurant, it's just too risky. My wife has some health issues, and I could not live with myself if I brought the virus home just because I wanted some chips and salsa. Just a couple of the reactions we're seeing out there, Laura. Lots of opinions on this one, as you might expect. I'll be back with more of those and more from social media later in the show.
Yeah, and we want to hear what you think. Are you being a little more adventurous, anxious to go out? You can find us on social media, Twitter or Facebook, or email texasstandard@kut.org.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Tech University's online school program, TTU K-12, offering fully online courses for kindergarten through 12th grade to start anytime from anywhere. Learn more by searching TTU K-12.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice. Each fall, fishers descend upon the Texas Gulf Coast for the Flounder Run. It's an annual migration of southern flounder. They leave the bays and the straits of the coastline for the open waters of the Gulf to spawn. Fishing during the run is a treasured tradition for Texas anglers, but now there are new rules for reeling in the flatfish. The Texas Standard's Michael Marks reports.
The Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission passed new regulations yesterday meant to protect and expand Texas's flounder population. Or, as Dacus Gieslin put it,
Commissioners, we're here before you today out of concern for the state's favorite flatfish, the southern flounder.
Gieslin is the Science and Policy Resources Manager for the Coastal Fisheries Division of Texas Parks and Wildlife. His presentation, held over video conference because of the coronavirus, included data that showed a decline in Texas flounder stretching back to the 80s. To reverse that, the commission approved two major changes: completely closing flounder season between November 1st and December 15th, and banning anglers from keeping any flounder under 15 inches long. The idea is to give more female flounder the chance to reproduce.
The male flounder rarely reach 14 inches, and nearly all the flounder harvested legally are those females.
It's a divisive proposal, though. A slight majority of the 1,100 comments Parks and Wildlife received supported the changes, including a quarter which didn't think they went far enough, but 36% opposed them. A lot of that resistance comes from the economic effect that closing flounder season for 6 weeks could have. Houston fisherman Mark Wong has fished for flounder along the Gulf for decades.
Bait shops, hotels, restaurants, gas stations, ice houses, things of that nature. This fall flounder season provides a tremendous economic boost to those businesses.
Captain Scott Maxwell runs one of those businesses. He's a fishing guide from Galveston who's helped people catch flounder for over 30 years.
You're talking about taking away 6 weeks of fishing from people that have been doing this their entire lives, people that make a living doing this, like I do.
Maxwell estimated he'll lose about $25,000 a year from the six-week closure. He and others who make a living from flounder also question the data that Parks and Wildlife used to make the new rules. They say that the methods used to measure flounder numbers don't accurately capture the population. And rather than seeing a decline, some commercial fishermen said that 2019 was one of their best years yet. Still, Gieslin from Parks and Wildlife said that one good year, however recent, does not offset the trend.
We recognize that there's occasionally good years in the fishery. That doesn't negate the fact of these clear and significant trends of declining populations of flounder.
Parks and Wildlife Commissioner Bobby Patton tried to stop a vote on the new regulations so more research could be done, but that effort failed. The commission passed the new rules 8-1. They'll go into effect on September 1st, 2021. For the Texas Standard, I'm Michael Marks.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, providing community relief actions for the COVID-19 crisis, including early dividend distribution to eligible policyholders. More at texasmutual.com/dividends.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. We're starting to measure the coronavirus pandemic in months rather than weeks, but if you're anything like us, you still have plenty of questions about the virus itself and how to handle it. That's why once a week we turn to Dr. Fred Campbell to get some of your questions answered. He's a doctor of internal medicine and associate professor of medicine at the Long School at UT Health San Antonio. Dr. Campbell, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
It's great to be with you again, Laura.
We have received a few different versions of this question, so let's start generally with a look at hydroxychloroquine. That is the drug that President Trump said earlier this week he'd been taking. What is it, and what are the recommendations for it right now as far as COVID-19 is concerned?
Hydroxychloroquine has been around a long time and has primarily been treatment for chronic rheumatologic disorders like rheumatoid arthritis. It also has some activity against malaria. In the early part of COVID-19, this drug was used due to theory about its effectiveness. There is an article in the Annals of Internal Medicine on May 13th, which is fairly definitive about the use of hydroxychloroquine. And due to preliminary failures of this drug to affect either prevention or treatment of COVID-19, it is advisable to use it only in the setting of a clinical trial where patients are enrolled to see if, in fact, there is any advantage.
Now, this next question was sent to us through our website by Mark Ashmead. Mark asks about contact tracing, which is the method of looking for and informing others who may have had contact with someone with a confirmed coronavirus case. He wanted to know if there are any results of the contact tracing done so far. If someone gets COVID-19, what information should they have on hand to help with contact tracing, and who should they give it to?
That is a critical question. They should certainly give all that information, if possible, to the local public health service in their community, for instance, Metro Health in San Antonio. They should be able to tell what their travels have been like and their interaction with people outside their families, over the preceding 2 weeks, because all of those individuals that come within 6 feet of someone that could conceivably have infection would need to be contact traced. And that could be a significant issue, particularly in people that are essential workers and have to go out into the field.
So this question comes from some members of the Texas Standard staff. Under Governor Abbott's most recent orders, childcare centers in Texas can now reopen. At first, we thought children weren't affected by COVID-19 as profoundly as other groups of people, but what do we know about an inflammatory disease now possibly linked to it?
Yes, the what's called a miscellaneous inflammatory syndrome in children, or MISC, affects a very, very small number of children who have had the coronavirus and have recovered, actually, then develop a severe inflammatory reaction, which can, in fact, lead to near-fatal or even fatal complications. It is a very, very uncommon aspect of COVID-19, but when it occurs with your child, can be very dangerous.
So at this point, with the scene in Texas, how comfortable would you be sending your child to daycare at the moment, Dr. Campbell?
Daycare, unfortunately, would be a situation where I think that there is still a significant risk of young people acquiring COVID-19. I would not be severely concerned on the basis of the MISC syndrome alone, because it is so unusual. But I believe the risk of transmission is quite high. These children could become infected. They could come home, be completely healthy, never develop any symptoms whatsoever, but unquestionably could pass the COVID-19 to high-risk individuals, and particularly elderly and those with chronic medical conditions.
We've been speaking with Dr. Fred Campbell. He's a doctor of internal medicine at the Long School at UT Health San Antonio. We'll have him on regularly over the course of the coronavirus pandemic to answer your questions. And if you have something you'd like to ask, find us on Twitter, Facebook, or go to texasstandard.org/coronavirus. You'll find a form there to submit your questions. Dr. Campbell, thank you so much again for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a privilege to help out.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Lauren Terrazas. All patients, residents, and staff at inpatient psychiatric hospitals and living centers will soon be tested for COVID-19. The Texas Health and Human Services Commission will be expanding testing at the 23 state-operated facilities. At least 161 patients and residents have tested positive for the virus. 107 have recovered. Today, restaurants in Texas can double their dine-in capacity to 50%. The increase is part of Governor Greg Abbott's ongoing plan to reopen the state's economy amid the COVID-19 outbreak. Emily Williams-Knight is the president and CEO of the Texas Restaurant Association. She expects some restaurants that remained closed at the 25% operating limit to open their doors now that it's up to 50%.
So we have received a number of calls and communications from restaurants that now at 50%, while it still be very hard for them to sustain that, it does give them the chance to come in and do the same as those before, which is make sure they've got the new protocol set, that employees are back, which is one of our number one goals, is to get people working again. And you will see a number of restaurants that will come online this weekend.
Knight adds the Texas restaurant industry has lost an estimated 700,000 jobs during the coronavirus pandemic, and that 12% of restaurants have closed for good. A number of establishments across Texas are allowed to reopen for the first time today since COVID-19 prompted statewide closures. They include bowling alleys, bingo halls, skating rinks, and aquariums. The Texas State Aquarium in Corpus Christi is among those welcoming back visitors today. Communications Director Jennifer Vela says they're excited to open up after 8 weeks. She adds they are taking a number of steps to protect public health, such as reducing certain programming and keeping the splash park closed.
However, all of our exhibits will be still open for viewing, so you'll still be able to get to see the dolphins, you'll still be able to get to see the sloths. It'll just be a much safer environment for the visitors to come and enjoy, really get out of the house and come enjoy safely.
Aquariums will be operating at 25% capacity. Texas beaches are bracing for crowds this Memorial Day weekend. Peter Davis heads the Galveston Island Beach Patrol. He says over the last few weeks, he's seen some people adhere to social distancing guidelines while other areas have been packed.
Also, I've noticed that lifeguards and the other public safety groups are the only ones basically wearing masks. A mask is a pretty rare thing to see out there on the beach. I'm hoping, you know, people are wearing them as they go into the stores and gas stations and, you know, restaurants now.
Public beaches reopened on May 1st. I'm Lauren Tarrazas for the Texas Standard.
You're listening to statewide news from public radio stations across Texas. This coverage is only possible because of support from listeners like you. You can help sustain and grow Texas news coverage by donating to your local public radio station today.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm Laura Rice. Baking, sewing, and DIY everything. Americans have gotten creative during shortages and to keep themselves busy while they've been stuck at home. The newfound obsession with homemade sourdough loaves has created a run on flour, leaving millers working overtime to keep up with what one company described to the New York Times as a consistently obscene demand for the baking staple. It seems like quarantine has awakened some sort of newfound desire for self-sufficiency, but as the Texas Standard's Alexandra Hart reports, things like growing your own food during tough times is as practical as it is therapeutic.
The pandemic didn't make Jenny Marie Jemison take up gardening, but it did give her a new sense of purpose while tending to her plants.
I mean, honestly, this is the best time to be a gardener that has ever. I love having my garden. I don't know what I would do without it. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to share it with other people.
Jemison picked up gardening about a year ago while she was recovering from an illness. And she documented her gardening journey on Instagram. Then COVID-19 reached Austin and a stay-at-home order was put in place. Her followers started reaching out and asking for tips. So she started Stay-at-Home Garden Club, guiding beginners through gardening in quarantine.
People want to have some sense of control, I feel like, something that they can do themselves. I feel like agency has sort of been taken away from people.
And that's not just a new phenomenon either. Americans have a long history of gardening in times of uncertainty.
When there is some big kind of existential threat, whether it's war or a pandemic, gardening and the ability to produce our own food becomes much more valuable. And that seems to be almost timeless.
That's Zachary Dolishal. He is an assistant professor in the Department of History at Sam Houston State University. Growing our own food is as old as civilization itself. But he says there are several movements in American history where amateur gardening played a major role. One of those is Freedom Villages, communities of freed slaves that came together during Reconstruction.
Hundreds of thousands of people who were enslaved and now they're liberated, and they need to make it on their own and with their own knowledge. And one of the major things they can rely on is their knowledge of the soil.
Excluded from society, these villages communally grew fruits and vegetables to feed themselves and to sell for a profit. Fast forward several decades to World Wars I and II, and you've got the birth of Victory Gardens. Dolishal says the government created groups like the Women's Land Army and the National War Garden Commission. Their goal was to encourage Americans to grow their own food to help the war effort.
You hear the Army, War, Army, right? These were organizations modeled after the military that would try to, and did, organize these people that were not really gardeners into gardeners. And so in the American imagination, it really sort of creates food production as a national security issue.
He says that push not only helped in a material way, but it also built a sense of pride and connectedness among communities. That's what Lauren Maples is trying to do with her organization, Partners for Education, Agriculture, and Sustainability, aka PEAS.
When we talk about being resilient in a community, it's about having the tools and resources to go beyond just sustaining our lives, but we need to be able to bounce back from some of these difficulties that have been facing us over the years, whether they're environmental or, in this case, with the COVID pandemic, it's a health crisis.
Maples is the founder and executive director of the Austin-based nonprofit that, during normal times, works with local schools to teach kids about growing food. but with campuses closed for the remainder of the academic year, she had to shift her focus.
We launched this Resiliency Gardens program to help support families that may be facing economic challenges or have food insecurity, to give them some tools to grow their own food at home.
She says that now, more than ever, people can use gardening to reclaim power in their lives. And that's especially true for people who have lost income during the pandemic.
I feel like many of the systems, political systems and other man-made systems have created a lot of invisible barriers for people in realizing how much power they really can have in their own lives, and especially with things like growing food.
Whether it's as a hobby or a tool for frugality, one thing is true. Gardening does have documented health benefits. A 2017 report that looked at 22 different studies on gardening found that it can have positive impacts on social, physical, and psychological health. Jemison knows that's true after using gardening to heal from her illness and its mental health effects. And she hopes that it can help others too, even when the future seems uncertain.
It gives you something to do that is outside of yourself, and it's outside of your house. It also is a way to see that time is actually passing. You see a plant grow from a seed to a mature plant, and that's real. And there's also a sense of accomplishment in that.
I'm Alexandra Hart for the Texas Standard.
Alejandro Cervantes Marti. I live in Austin, Texas, which is actually a beautiful place. It's like a hot grassland. All right, so I'm 9 years old. So during the quarantine, I've been making like science videos, but not just based on science, it's also based on like language arts. And my mom thought of the idea to make it like a news program. So that's what we did. And we had a scientist named Dr. Uzbekistan, named after the Asian country. Everything is just me, but in a different pair of clothes. Good afternoon and welcome to Quarantine Science News. Today we are going to be talking about invasive species. We have Dr. Uzbekistan, which was talking about a specific animal from Puerto Rico, which is an island in the Caribbean or Caribbean.
Hello. So what makes a species invasive? Animals and plants are invasive because they are introduced into another country.
And this was an amphibian called the coqui frog. In scientific name, it's hard to say it, but it's like Eutherodactylus coqui, which means free toes, not toast, but toes. Because unlike other frogs, they actually have no webbed feet.
Good afternoon and welcome back to Quarantine Science News. Last week we had Dr. Uzbekistan talking about the coqui frog being an invasive.
First, I'm going to talk about another one that I made. This was based on the Earth, the Moon, and the Sun.
We have Dr. Joe from NASA that is going to be talking about this subject.
I was a scientist from NASA named Dr. Joe, which was talking about the moon phases, how the Earth and the Sun rotate around each other, and the days on Earth.
The Earth turns on its axis every day. Right here is a model of the solar system.
And I also made one like breaking news thing. Instead, like regular news, it's breaking news. And the point of that was with pollution in the oceans. So I pretended to be a marine biologist talking about how plastic pollutes our oceans and what we need to do to stop it. All right, so like my family, including my dad, my mom, and my brother, Like, so we make a script, and like my brother holds it and my mom records. And we also made like a green screen, but in the first video we used like our TV, which had YouTube on it, if you know what YouTube is. All right, so I think my next project would be kind of funny. Like, just imagine it being like a news program about like a zombie apocalypse. But I'm pretty sure that wouldn't be for like a project, like a school project. I think it would need to be like just for fun. Goodbye. My name is Diego Alejandro Cervantes Marti, and I am 9 years old. And you are listening to the Texas Standard.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Laura Rice, in for David Brown. A horrific number coming up. COVID-19 has killed nearly 100,000 Americans. And as we well know, social distancing and stay-at-home orders have complicated an already painful time. Preparation for funerals and memorials have been transformed because of the coronavirus. The outbreak has also upended how end-of-life workers, like morticians and funeral directors, do their jobs. KERA North Texas's Hadi Mawagdi talked with several to learn how they're adjusting their work and helping families grieve.
If you ask KO Tran to list the heroes of the coronavirus pandemic, she won't start with doctors or even grocery store cashiers.
You know, people have been talking about, oh, like frontline workers and this, and it's like no one ever mentions mortuary, cemetery, cremation workers. But I'm like, people die every single day, like all the time, you know, like this has to be handled. And they're the ones that are doing the things that no one wants to do.
Tran is the founder of a Dallas-based discussion group called Life and Death Forum. And up until April, when she was laid off, she also worked in sales for the funeral industry and developed a deep respect for the people she worked beside.
It takes a lot to like wake up in the middle of the night, go pick up their body, take them back, and then like embalm them and do all of those things. Then you have to meet with the family. So like that is truly like a service.
A service Glenda Stansbury is trying to adapt for the times.
We're the last ones that get to care for those bodies and care for those families. Whether it's COVID or not, death is going to happen and we have to be there.
Stansbury's a funeral director and a celebrant in Oklahoma City. When planning a service, she says she can spend hours talking to relatives of a deceased loved one, something she says is intimate and often emotionally difficult.
How do I express comfort to somebody when I can't hug them, when I can't hold their hand, when I can't do the kinds of things that we as human beings do?
The COVID-19 outbreak has forced her and the whole profession to rethink every aspect of the job, starting with the funeral itself. Stansbury is one of many who've started performing funeral services online via video chat, like this one.
Well, thank you all for giving me the opportunity to do this. This is so special that we get to gather in a very unique way, and we'll all get through this together. It's a new experience for everybody.
Funeral director Jimmy Lucas has started doing these too. His family has been in the industry for 160 years, and they own 5 funeral homes across North Texas. Like Stansbury, Lucas is dedicated to helping families find closure after the death of a loved one.
I think that good grief and the grief process starts with a funeral service, a celebration of life, a service of remembrance. And so that's our mission and our focus. And COVID-19 has changed that dramatically.
Some of the changes were practical and behind the scenes. Lucas had employees start wearing personal protective equipment and required office staff to socially distance. Lucas says if they're not safe, then they can't work. And if they can't work, then no one is around to perform and plan funerals.
And so we quickly transitioned into e-documents, and we went to online arrangements, meaning that we can be on the phone with them. And that's worked really well for us.
Still, both Lucas and Stansbury say families want to come into the funeral home, and they want to have in-person discussions about burials and other details.
That's been the biggest struggle for funeral directors. We bend over backwards to say yes to families. You know, what do you need? What are we going to do? How can we make this happen for you? This is our job. And then all of a sudden, we're having to say no.
Working during the pandemic has been a balancing act for funeral workers. They've had to balance their health with the health of their clients, along with countless other factors. And just like frontline workers, the folks on the final line are working tirelessly to heal our hearts and to bring rest to the ones we've lost. I'm Hadi Mawagdi in Dallas.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Fruchter, and I'm with the Typewriter Rodeo. We're a group of friends who take our vintage manual typewriters to various events and write custom poems on the spot. A holy month in the time of pandemic. The walls of the mosque sing to themselves this Ramadan, especially late in the evening when the remembered prayers of Taraweeh echo, and the running of small feet, this year only echoes and memory. It is as if the tantalizing aromas of iftar leftovers waiting to be shared still drift through still air. But this year, fellowship and prayer are staying home, and the tea urns are empty. Perhaps it is easier without the distractions of seeing old familiar faces, finding their places, the coveted prayer spots, and voices raised in greeting. Easier to practice dhikr, the meditation in remembrance of Allah, to focus on worship, to get enough sleep for a change. Perhaps. And the net that connects all believers still touches each one of us. Sometimes it uses Zoom, and one could weep from the purity of it this Ramadan, the purity and the loneliness. I'm David Fruchter with the Typewriter Rodeo, and you are listening to the Texas Standard.
Support for the Typewriter Rodeo comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
Have an idea for a poem? Let us know. Send your requests on social media or email texasstandard@kut.org. Time now to turn to the week that was in Texas politics, as we do every Friday. Here with us today is Matthew Watkins. He's managing editor of News and Politics for the Texas Tribune. Matthew, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
On Thursday, Texas Governor Greg Abbott made an announcement regarding travel restrictions. What's the latest there?
Yeah, you know, there had been some restrictions that Abbott had imposed, basically banning travel or requiring certain limitations from people flying on airplanes from kind of some of the hotspot areas, you know, the tri-state region up around New York, New Orleans. And Abbott has now lifted those restrictions so the planes can fly freely. It's kind of one more step in the continued reopening that Abbott has been pushing over the last weeks and month.
So another step, though, he took was about state budgets. And I guess he's asking at least some state agencies to cut back. What are the details there? Is it just some or is it everybody across the board?
It's most of them. There's a few exceptions, you know, including Child Protective Services, which has been requiring some extra cash lately. But most agencies, higher education institutions, things like that, are being told to cut back 5% on their current budget. This is a pretty standard move when things are looking pretty grim for the appropriations process in the future. The legislature doesn't meet again until 2021. Obviously, state revenue is low, and basically they don't want to be in a situation where they have to kind of make up all of that gap in the next budget. So what they're doing is they're cutting into this budget right now in order to, you know, kind of spread out the pain at least a little bit over the next few years.
Meanwhile, some efforts to continue to restart the economy and more businesses opening. What's on the schedule next?
Yeah, well, today is the day for a lot of different kinds of businesses, particularly entertainment-oriented businesses. Bars opening for the first time today, bowling alleys, bingo halls, skating rinks, rodeos, zoos, and aquariums are on the list today. Restaurants, which, as y'all know, have been open for a while, can now operate at 50% capacity instead of 25% capacity.
Now, this might be anecdotal, but what evidence, or do we have evidence right now that folks seem to be coming out to the businesses that have already reopened? I'm thinking hair salons, like you mentioned, restaurants and theaters.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's actually the big question is obviously this isn't just up to Abbott. You know, people have to decide that they feel comfortable going out in order for these businesses to kind of pick back up, which is what Abbott's trying to do here. You know, it kind of depends. You know, I know just anecdotally, you know, being out the grocery store, I've not seen a lot of people at restaurants and things like that. But we do know hair salons did see a pretty strong uptake in business as soon as they opened. You know, some of our reporters talked to barbers who were booked, you know, for days. So it depends, you know, in some areas there's pent up demand in things that people find very necessary. Other things that are more leisurely, you know, we're seeing in some cases that even if you're allowed to open at 50% capacity, for instance, that doesn't mean kind of 50% of your regular business is ready to return yet.
Matthew Watkins is managing editor of News and Politics for the Texas Tribune. Matthew, thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. And turning back now again to social media editor Wells Dunbar. Wells, what are Texans talking about?
Hey, Laura. Well, we're continuing to hear from our friends and listeners out there about Texas' evolving reopening of businesses, restaurants, bars, and the like. Here are some more reactions we're hearing out there. This one via Twitter from Matt. He says he would go out only if we had a contact tracing team, easy access to testing, and if people would use face covers out in public. But sadly, we don't have all of that. He adds that the federal government should be giving Americans a check every month until we get a vaccine, and the vaccine rate is at a high percentage. Of course, that isn't currently happening, so many folks left with a few options other than to go back to work. Via Facebook, we have an interesting comment here from Tim Davis, who's a small business owner, I believe a tattoo parlor. He says, I own a small business and I have people who have to get back to work. But he adds, it's a new policy for everybody to wear a mask, including clients. He goes on to share this story, which I find pretty interesting, Laura. He says, the funny thing is a so-called safety cleaning service came to the shop to sell me on their services. They would come in and do heightened hospital type cleaning. But he notes that the salesman and his workers were not wearing masks. So he doesn't understand the disconnect there. You know, obviously sort of turned into somewhat of a political issue, although I think lots of people would argue that it should be removed from the realm of politics and is squarely a public health issue. So lots of conversation about that as well. Lots of conversation about that fun piece we heard earlier in the program about gardening and its apparent resurgence here amid the COVID-19 pandemic. That's right. Yeah. Eric Ivan Garcia Riviera, he notes he has two raised beds that is chaotically filled with all sorts of veggies and lots of potted mini trees, things from figs to lemons to tamarind and even a date tree. Just one of the comments we have there, Laura.
All right. Well, that sounds good, Wells. And we are keeping those lines of communication open. So let us know what is on your mind as far as reopening, what your plans are for the Memorial Day weekend, if you're having one, and have a great one.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family. Would your company or organization like to be a sponsor as well? Contact your local station for opportunities within your community. For statewide sponsorships,
visit texaspublicmedianetwork.com.